Bolt your doors, lock your windows, turn off your lights, and come with me into the weird darkness. I'm Darren Marlar, bringing you true stories of the paranormal, supernatural, legends, lore, crime, conspiracy, mysterious, macabre, unsolved, and unexplained 7 days a week. Recently voted number 2 in the best horror true crime podcasts for 2020 by Podcast Magazine. Search for Weird Darkness wherever you listen to podcasts.
One of my 1989 aerobic videos. What can I say? I'm an old-fashioned gal. I never got rid of the VHS player, and what can I say? I like Jane Fonda. Whew, I tell you what, there's only so many butt clenches a woman can do. Know what I mean? Ugh. I'm trying to get fit this year. Although my body is in great shape, I realize exercise is good for the soul too. And it's way too cold to go outside. It's snowing here where I live. -10 degrees. Ugh. Ice everywhere. I prefer to stay indoors. I can't get Reggie out of my bed. He's already eaten 2 of my silk pillows. So, on to the first story. Did you ever go to Disney World as a kid? Well, I bet this never happened to you.
Hi, I'm Dan, and these are 2 unexplained things that happened to me in my life. I was 12 years old, and it was July 1992. My parents have been divorced since I was 2. My father flew for the airlines, and I was able to get free flights all over the U.S. So he would take me on vacation during the summer to lots of fun places. Disney World in Florida was somewhere I loved to go, and one summer my dad took me. That one trip to Disney was unlike any others. We were having a great day. I was in my element, going on all the exciting rides, eating junk food and spending quality time with my dad. My favorite ride was the Haunted Mansion. Disney World does a really good job of letting you believe that the ghosts you see are real. They are all projections, of course, but they do an amazing job at it. During the ride, you see a bunch of hitchhiker ghosts trying to catch a ride with you. At the end of the ride, the cart that you are sitting in faces a bunch of mirrors. Those mirrors then show you that you picked up one of the hitchhikers, and that they are going with you out of the ride. Well, I think we really did pick one up. When we got back to our hotel, we noticed all of our things were spread throughout the room. When we left, they were all neatly stacked and put away. My dad thought perhaps the housekeeping person ransacked our room looking for money or valuables, so he reported it. But when we got home back to New Jersey, that's when things got really interesting. The next day, I sat down to watch my Saturday morning cartoons, and my dad went to open a brand new package of cookies. To his surprise, some were missing. And one had a bite missing from it. He came over to me and asked if I did it, and tried to blame me for it. I told him no, and reminded him that the package was new and unopened, as we bought it right before our trip to Disney. We also started to notice things, like lights turning on by themselves, and doors opening on their own that would always be shut prior. At first, this stuff really freaked me out. And then, I guess, you know, we just got used to it. And this went on for many months. Until finally, all of a sudden, they all stopped. It just went away. It never came back. I guess our hitchhiker found a new ride. When I was a young adult, my wife and I were planning a little trip to her grandmother's house for a visit. She didn't live too far away, and we had often went over there, almost on a weekly basis. Ever since we were together, we were, you know, very tight with her family. So we decided we were going to go to her house, and it was in the evening. So we headed out and started driving towards her house. Unlike, you know, any other time. It was just a normal time. But we started to notice something. Shortly after we left the house, we noticed a bright light in the sky, just hovering there. Our area is full of planes and helicopters. We live right outside the city of Philadelphia, so there's tons of that kind of air traffic activity. So we easily thought it was one of them at first. But it didn't move. And it was really bright. Brighter than a star. So I pulled over. And we both looked at it for a few minutes, trying to figure out what it was. Then, suddenly, it made some very fast, irregular movements. And darted off at a 90-degree angle, and then vanished. Growing up around planes with my father, as well as with him being in the Air Force, I knew that nothing man-made could move like that and then suddenly disappear into thin air. It must have been a UFO of some sort, and it went into warp speed and left.
Lock the doors, turn out the lights, and climb into bed. It's time for Hillbilly Dead Time Stories.
This is Jerry from the Hillbilly Horror Stories podcast. You just heard the intro to our new video series on YouTube, Hillbilly Dead Time Stories. I hope you'll check it out. If you're not really a video person, check out the Hillbilly Horror Stories podcast, where my wife Tracy and myself will give you a new story of the unexplained every week. You can check out the audio version of Hillbilly Dead Time Stories as a bonus episode every Wednesday.
One, two, three, four. That's enough of that. I'm pooped. Well, while I take a well-earned shower, you sit back and listen to these stories. These are from Tony and Jean Jevon, a lovely married couple that live in the UK. They both had two strange incidents that happened to each one of them back in the 70s.
Hi. I'm Tony Jevon, and this is my story. I was living in Torquay, England, in 1959. I was 17 years old, and I was an apprentice plumber. I got together with a mate, Lawrence Hobbis, to form a band. There was Lawrence, the drummer, me on vocals, John, the rhythm guitarist, and Terry, lead guitarist. We also had various bassists that came and went, as bassists do. We were called Tony and the Orbits. We did covers of Elvis, Cliff, Billy Fury, everyone really, as well as standards and ballads. We started out in St Luke's Church Hall, Torquay, and went on to play in local hotels, the popular 400 Club, and the Princess Theatre, which was newly opened then. We rehearsed twice weekly and acquired ourselves a manager, Trevor George, who was well known in the West Country. We got to be quite good and had a big following of fans. In the autumn of 1962, Trevor got us an audition for Opportunity Knocks with Huey Green at the Princess Theatre. It was at the end of this audition that the incident occurred. We left the theatre quite late that night, and John was stuck for a lift home to Peyton, so I offered to give him a lift. He lived on a brand new housing estate. He hadn't lived there long, but it was no problem to give him a lift home. We listened to late night radio as we drove along. We talked about the audition and how much we hoped we would get the gig. It must have been about 11 p.m. when we turned into the council estate where he lived. As I drove along, I could see someone standing on the edge of the curb. He appeared to be of medium build, height. He was wearing a trilby hat, and his coat collar was pulled right up, and his hat was down low, so you couldn't really see any features on his face. He was mostly in the shadow, standing right under the streetlight. He was just standing there, staring across the road in front of him. He was right on the edge of the curb. I remember wondering what this guy was doing at this time of night. Was he waiting for someone? Was he just having a quick smoke? Although I didn't see him holding a cigarette. I knew he was going to step off the curb, and I said to John, "This guy's going to step out in the road." John wasn't listening. He was changing the station on the radio, so I eased the car into the crown of the road so to avoid him, but it was too late. The guy stepped right out in front of the car. I hit the brakes and the fellow went down. He was gone. I shouted, "I've hit him!" I looked across at John, who'd been launched forward in his seat from the impact of the sudden stop. There were no seatbelts in cars back then, and John had slammed into the front windscreen. He looked at me in shock and shouted, "Who? Hit who?" We both jumped out of the car and ran round the bonnet to the front. He wasn't there. We searched underneath the car and all around. Where was he? The man was nowhere to be seen. I could feel my heart pounding in my chest. The modern housing estate was well lit up, with street lamps everywhere with grassy areas. But the chap had disappeared. He'd simply vanished. There's no way he could have got up and walked away. We would have seen him. And he was definitely there. I saw him clear as day, step out right in front of my car. No doubt in my mind. It's 50 years since this happened, and to this day I can't explain it. But it was real, and I believe whatever stepped out in front of my car that night was not a living, breathing person, and I will never forget it.
Hiya, my name is Jean Jevon, and this is about the South Road mystery. My husband and I moved to number 1 South Road, Lancaster, in January 1974. Our first son, Gary, was 2 years old, and 1 month later, our second son, Glenn, was born, so our family was complete. It was a big end-of-terraced house, 3 stories high, 2 reception rooms, kitchen and scullery, plus 2 cellars. We loved the house, although it was always very difficult to keep warm, and sometimes on the first floor landing, there was an atmosphere. Not really scary, but strange. I couldn't really put my finger on it. But this particular incident began in September 1975. Gary, our eldest, used to like to play at the bottom of the stairs. And one day I noticed he was chatting away as he was playing. I thought he might have an imaginary friend. And I asked him, "Who are you talking to, Gary?" He looked up at me and replied, "I'm talking to the man on the stairs. He's a nice man." This happened quite a few times. He was never scared or upset, but chatted away quite happily. We have no explanation for this, so we just left him to it. Something that happened each Christmas that we lived there was a letter addressed to a Mrs. Dodson arrived and then was duly collected by her. The letter would come, and then shortly afterwards she would knock round to collect it. Mrs. Dodson had lived in the property before us. We didn't mind her collecting this yearly envelope, and we never really questioned it. The last Christmas that we were there was 1976. When Mrs. Dodson came for the envelope, as she always did, I told her that we were going to move out shortly after the new year, and I decided to finally ask her about the envelope. She told me the story. She had lived at our address with her husband Jackie for many years. One day, Jackie had a massive heart attack. He fell down the stairs and unfortunately was dead when he reached the bottom. Every Christmas afterwards, she had received a card with money in it from an anonymous, grateful mother for the kindness Jackie had shown her children. After speaking to Mrs. Dodson, I asked my dad about Jackie, and he told me he was a really lovely man. He spent a lot of time volunteering with poor families and children. So, perhaps Gary really did have a special friend on those stairs in Jackie.
It was the summer of 2015 when I moved in, and at first appearances, my housemate and landlord Mike was somewhat normal, if not a bit socially awkward and dysfunctional. When I was signing the papers, he was adamant that I should never go into the basement, which I thought was a bit odd, but I really needed a place to stay and, well, people have their little quirks, so I just chalked it up to that at the time. As I got to know Mike, and our cohabitation continued, I learned more about the depths of his dysfunction. Firstly, that he used meth. Now, I don't automatically judge people based on vices, and I was surprised at the extent of his use. He was probably the first person I knew who used meth and balanced a full-time job, and enjoyed a decent amount of success. The reason this is important to the story is that when he would be around the house, drinking and using meth, he would start to run off at the mouth. He would often joke that if I smelled lye coming from the basement, not to think anything of it. I think it was probably the third time he said this that I asked why he keeps saying that, and he said, "I use chemicals to clean up the bodies," with a wily grin on his face. I tried to chalk that up to a bad sense of humour, but it didn't sit right with me. He was also very particular that I let him know of my coming and going and my work schedule. I remember him being shocked and uncomfortable one day that I ended up taking time off work because he didn't realise that I was home. I remember that day because there was a lot of clanging and what sounded like muffled shouting coming from the basement. His car was in the driveway, but he was not in the main house or his bedroom. Other days he would play very loud music that bumped through the whole house. Sometimes he would even play NPR talk radio at those volumes. In retrospect, I think he might have been trying to mask sounds. He would make remarks about sex workers saying, "You can do whatever you want, you can choke them or beat them to death and nobody cares." I took exception to this. I told him I thought that was messed up. But when he would get tweaking, he'd always come back around to alluding to the same kind of violence. Talking about how he was a normal white guy who owned a house and had a good career, so the police would never suspect him. At this point, I started to think that it had gone too far to simply be a joke. I was in a weird position, because money was tight at the time, and my options were few. I tried to convince myself that even if he is messed up, he is probably just engaging in outward fantasism. I knew that he would acquire the services of sex workers on occasion, but again, I didn't judge that activity at face value, but started becoming concerned. Then, at one point, when I was doing laundry, I caught whiffs of decomposition. The house we were in was in southeast Portland. It was relatively new. Having grown up in upstate New York, I know that animals can be trapped in walls and die, but this was the garage, and there were no animals scurrying in the walls. This was strange and telling to me. I considered carefully what I would do and decided I would confront him about the smell. I decided to poise the question in a somewhat suggestive way by expanding on his jokes. I told him that he needs to do a better job cleaning up the bodies because I smell decomposition from the garage. I will never forget his reaction. His eyes widened, and he shot me a sharp glare, somewhere between fear and anger. He stumbled over his words and eventually responded, "What? Really?" I said, "Yes, really." And there was a few seconds of awkwardness before he said, "Thanks for letting me know," and promptly went into his bedroom and shut the door. A few days after that, he went into the upper crawl space in the garage while I was again doing laundry. He called for me and was trying to convince me to come up into the crawl space. My body locked up, and it was like my instincts were screaming at me that if I went up there, I would not come back down. I gave some excuse that I can sparsely remember that I had to be someplace, packed up my laundry, threw it in my room, and left. He spent a lot of time in the padlocked basement without a doorknob. The only way in was through the backyard. I wish I would have gone down there in retrospect, to either confirm or dismiss the suspicions once and for all. In the last couple of months I had lived there, I was privy to more graphic comments about women and sex workers, explicit talk of sexual violence, and he was using more and more. He once showed me a video he made. He is a graphic designer and artist as well, which featured heavy bondage themes, interspersed with distorted audio of women screaming, and this strange leering figure in a plague doctor costume. It was one of those situations where any of those things alone may be explainable, but as they accumulated, it became suspicious to me. It was October of 2016 that I left there. A mix of feeling called to action and having nothing to lose as I wanted to get out of that house in the worst way. My last night there, I didn't give notice that I was leaving, he was drinking and tweaking again. Starting in the same conversation, loosely describing murder and sexual violence in the tone of some sort of edgy joke. I told him he would be caught eventually, not even holding back my suspicion anymore. He reiterated that he was the last person police would suspect and asserted that they couldn't catch him. He said this in a very serious and concise way, dropping the pretense he had been using before. I left the next morning. This haunted me for months, then a year, then a year and a half. I felt as though I hadn't done anything. The guilt was eating away at me, so I called Portland Crime Stoppers and put in an anonymous tip describing what I had described here. When I did, the operator started going back and forth, putting me on hold because the call had quipped the interest of the police sergeant who was assigned to the call centre. So they were asking me detailed questions about his vehicle, his house, the methods he described. It seemed like they took interest. I gave them as much information as I could remember and left it at that, feeling just a little bit better that I had at least tried to do something about it. Fast forward to recent times, I told my mother about all of this, and she became interested, asking what house this was, and she ended up pulling it up on GMaps. She put up the street view, and I noticed that there was a large enclosed trailer in the driveway that wasn't there when I was. I could theorise why it might have been there, but cannot put together a practical reason for it, or why he'd be using it, unless he was moving or using it to haul things to discard. Admittedly, that is pure conjecture, but I couldn't help but wonder. I doubt that I will ever get closure, or have my suspicions validated unless he finally does get caught and arrested, and I read about it. I have grown up poor and been around the lowlife a lot. I have interacted with many sketchy and unsavoury people in my time, but none of them have ever made the impression that Mike made on me. Make of it what you will, but I hope I will never meet him again. I'm doing some yoga and meditation. Learning the art of relaxation. Oh, darn it. Hold on. Hello, Deadly Debbie residents. Oh, Mother, it's you. Yes, Mother, I did. No, Mother, I'm not. Oh, how many times? Yes, yes, see you next week. And don't forget to take your false teeth out tonight. You nearly choked on them last week. Goodbye. Ugh, there goes my relaxation. Oh, it's that time again. It's review time. The next review is by Scott Gold. And he said, a great listen to real people's paranormal experiences of things that are not meant to happen,
but actually do really happen. Do yourself a favor and use this podcast to hear evidence of such things. And even better, add your own experiences so we can all let others know, so nobody has to feel left in the dark on their own to scare, to release. Oh, I see, you said too scared to release of what they have experienced among themselves of such great things that exist among us all. Well, kiddies, I'll see you next week for more true tales of the unexplained. Sleep well.